All through that winter, the fleet's frigates were employed in harrying French invasion forces in their harbours along the Channel coast, causing more irritation than harm, but exciting the British press to some effect. Fear at home had precipitated political upheaval at the heart of government. In the spring of 1804, William Pitt replaced Henry Addington as Prime Minister, and St Vincent was removed from the Admiralty. Collingwood's short time in Culloden, just 3 months, was unremarkable, but he was given his promotion to Vice-Admiral of the Blue. Now he was back cruising off Ushant. His thoughts strayed to Northumberland, where he hoped his girls were being virtuously educated. And even with his many cares, he had time to feel for a fellow Geordie, a nurseryman from Ryton, who'd been pressed into the Navy on the grounds that he'd once been to sea when young. "They have broken up his good business at home," wrote Collingwood, "distressed his family, and sent him here where he is of little or no service. I grieve for him, poor man." Still, the invasion did not come. Bonaparte, perhaps, was busy. He had just had himself crowned Emperor of France. "As much villainy as ever disgraced nature in the person of one man," was Collingwood's verdict. But prospects of an end to the war were bleak. England apart, there was no power in Europe to compete with the new empire. Russia cannot, Prussia will not, Austria dare not. All the rest must do as they are ordered, wrote Collingwood. All the rest included Spain, whose passive aid to France was becoming active, and against whom Britain declared war too. Collingwood, meanwhile, had changed ships again. After a brief spell in Prince, the 98-gun first rate in which he'd been flag captain in 1793, he was given Dreadnought, another three-decker, which he immediately liked, though he complained that as a result of St. Vincent's savings, she had been fitted out by unqualified contractors and needed a great deal of work to set her right. Nevertheless, within a year he'd worked her crew up to such a pitch of perfection that she recorded the fastest rate of broadside firing that the Navy had ever seen. Collingwood's view, shared by Nelson and others of their persuasion, was that to defeat the enemy the fleet must bring overwhelming firepower to bear. Faster, more accurate, more determined, and more prolonged. No enemy could compete with the staggering rate of 3 broadsides in 3.5 minutes that Collingwood achieved. The situation in Europe was as bleak as it had ever been. Napoleon's mastery of the continent would continue for many more years. Where the new emperor was vulnerable was at sea. The most brilliant general since Julius Caesar, Napoleon was able to calculate military strategy with great precision. But he never understood the sea, where the margin for error was always much greater. Nor did he have senior officers of the calibre of Collingwood and Nelson. He was right when he said he only needed to control the English Channel for a day to become master of Britain. But he underestimated how long a day could last at sea. Throughout the early part of 1805, he watched and waited as his army of England champed at the bit in the harbours and ports of the Channel. Orders had gone out to the fleets at Brest, Rochefort and Toulon to escape their blockades, head for the West Indies with the Spanish fleet to distract the English, rendezvous there, and head back for the Channel, all by a certain date. Napoleon's idea was to make a landing in Ireland with overwhelming force, drawing the British forces there and leaving the Channel clear. Nelson headed after them with a squadron once their destination was known, but narrowly missed them. Collingwood stayed behind, patrolling off Cadiz, his own thoughts on the matter showing, not for the last time, that he at least had not been fooled. "I think it is not improbable," he wrote, "that I shall have all those fellows coming from the West Indies again before the hurricane months, unless they sail from thence directly for Ireland, which I have always had an idea was their plan, for this Bonaparte has as many tricks as a monkey. I believe their object in the West Indies to be less conquest than to draw our force from home." Nelson, frustrated by having missed Admiral Villeneuve's force in the West Indies, returned to Gibraltar. And from there he corresponded with Collingwood, who was at Cadiz keeping the returned combined fleet under surveillance. They were of the same mind, straining all their resources, mostly frigates and what little intelligence was to be had in the Mediterranean, to anticipate the next move of the enemy. But Collingwood had an additional problem, as he complained to his sister. "I have a diligent young man for my secretary, and Clavel, my lieutenant, is the spirit of the ship. But such a captain, Rotherham, such a stick. I wonder very much how such people get forward. I should, I firmly believe, with his nautical ability and knowledge and exertion, have been a bad lieutenant at this day. Was he brought up in the navy? For he has very much the style of the coal trade about him, except that they are good seamen. Edward Rotherham, a Hexham man, had indeed been brought up in the coal trade, and although Collingwood notoriously disliked having any sort of a flag captain under him, Rotherham does seem to have been uniquely bad at his job, as a fellow officer later recalled. Collingwood's dry, caustic mind lives before me in the recollection of his calling across the deck his fat, stupid captain, long since dead, when he had seen him commit some monstrous blunder. And after the usual bowing and formality, which the excellent old chief never omitted, he said, "Captain Rotherham, I have been thinking whilst I looked at you, how strange it is that a man should grow so big and know so little. That's all, sir, that's all." Hats off, low bows. Because of the events of October 1805, the world has generally forgotten what happened on August the 20th of that year. It was one of the most brilliant naval actions of the war, although hardly a gun was fired. It began when Collingwood, in Dreadnought, with Colossus and Achille and the Niger, a frigate, were patrolling off Cadiz. Over the horizon that morning, just after dawn, came 26 enemy ships. Collingwood's tiny squadron lay between them and 8 Spanish ships in the port. There was nothing he could do but run for it, knowing that the odds of escaping such a fleet with his slow old ships, let alone fighting them, were negligible. 2 hours later, 16 of the enemy's fastest ships were detached and sent after him as he made for Gibraltar. Now, knowing the situation was critical, Collingwood pulled off a masterstroke. He shortened sail, turned back, and sent the very fast Colossus off to get as close to the enemy as possible, meanwhile throwing out a series of signals. The enemy saw that Collingwood must have sighted a large British force in the distance and that he decided to wait for them and fight. So the French turned tail and fled back to Cadiz. 16 ships of the line had been seen off by just 3. The stage was now set. Russia, Sweden and Austria had joined Britain in a grand coalition against France. Bonaparte had to strike soon. On the continent his target was Austria. In December he would destroy her armies at Austerlitz. Admiral Villeneuve, with 35 ships of the combined fleet, was kept under constant watch by Collingwood, now reinforced and with 26 ships. Nelson, in the Victory, had gone back to England for a few weeks' leave, while Collingwood, as ever, stuck to his duty. With summer waning towards autumn, it was now or never. Napoleon sensed that the season was too late for another invasion attempt, and ordered Villeneuve to break out of Cadiz and head for the Mediterranean. Villeneuve, depressed and having little confidence in the combined fleet, found excuses to stay in Cadiz. He knew his crews were no match for English sailors who'd been almost constantly at sea for 12 years. He had little faith in the effectiveness of the Spanish, even with their ship's massive firepower. But at last his hand was forced. Word reached him that Napoleon had sent an officer to supersede him, and that on being recalled to Paris he would feel the fury of his master's displeasure. Nelson, meanwhile, left England for the last time, and came to take over the blockading squadron from his old friend. There were to be no little jealousies, he said. No man had more faith in another than he had in his friend, and Collingwood was to be given complete freedom of action. But Nelson also played a little joke on his old comrade. He had brought Collingwood Royal Sovereign, 100-gun ship like the Victory. But Royal Sovereign was known in the service as the West Country Wagon, a notoriously slow sailor, even more so than Collingwood's dear old Dreadnought. Was this an insult? What Collingwood did not know, until he joined her, was that she'd just been freshly recoppered, and with a smooth, gleaming hull was transformed into the fastest ship in the British fleet. Although he was sad to lose a crew that were used to his ways and were perfectly ready for battle, he found his new ship to be in very good shape. He took most of his officers and some of his men with him. Nelson and Collingwood met once again on board Victory, where, with the other captains and admirals in the fleet, Nelson explained his plan of battle, should Villeneuve be persuaded to come out. Nelson called it, with typical immodesty, the Nelson touch. The idea was that, facing a numerically larger fleet, The British force would try to detach a part of the enemy from the battle and defeat the rest before they could rejoin. He was counting on a conservative approach from the combined fleet. They would probably form a single line, as was traditional. Nelson would form his ships into two lines, and instead of the two fleets closing each other on parallel courses, he would have his two lines attack at nearly right angles, breaking the enemy line a third of the way from the front and the rear. The vanguard of the enemy would be cut off long enough for victory to be secured before they could rejoin. This was not quite such a radical idea as has often been argued, but it did have the merit of being conceived in the Nelsonian way. Within the plan, each captain was free to improvise, and the crucial thing was to get as close to the enemy as quickly as possible and destroy him with accurate gunfire. There was an additional advantage. The officers and men of the British fleet knew that with Nelson leading them, they could not lose. The enemy believed they could not win.